welcome everyone to episode 5 of True Crime All the Time Unsolved. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me as always is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you today?
Hey, I'm doing good, man.
I never have a good reply for that.
It throws you off.
I gotta work on that.
You want me to say like, oh man, let me tell you about my day.
No, it's just like, Gibby, how are you? And once you say something, I got nothing.
You got nothing.
I got nothing.
It's what it is.
All right, Gib. So let's let the listeners in on what we're talking about today.
Sure.
The case is Suzanne Jovan.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is a case that occurred up at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Most people from the United States, anyway, will know what Yale is. I mean, that's a very prestigious university.
Yeah, one of the big Ivy Leagues, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Definitely. So let's talk a little bit about Suzanne. There wasn't a ton of information out there on her life and upbringing.
No.
Which is something we usually try to cover, I don't want to say extensively, but we usually like to try to give as much background as we can. And what we do know is that, you know, she was a German-born American. And at the time of her death, she was a senior at Yale University. And what happened was she was brutally stabbed to death off campus. The city of New Haven and Yale University, they've combined to offer a $150,000 reward for information that leads to the arrest and conviction of her killer. But as of today, this case remains unsolved, which is why it's on True Crime All the Time Unsolved.
Exactly.
So, Gibby, we got to start with the facts of the case. What I have is that she was in the process, or this murder occurred after she had dropped off her senior essay, which just happened to be on Osama bin Laden. And this occurred around 4 o'clock on Friday, December 4th, 1998. Then she started making preparations for a party that she had organized at the Lutheran Church on Orange Street for the local chapter of what's called Best Buddies. So Best Buddies, Gib, from what I understand, is an international organization that brings together students and mentally disabled adults.
Yeah.
So she's organizing this pizza making party. By all accounts, I mean, she's doing something nice.
Yeah. I mean, clearly she's very intelligent.
Yes, because she's at Yale.
Yep. And then she has the community outreach type of personality, right? I mean, right. She's doing good things.
She's
like
giving
that up
her own time to help out.
Yeah. I mean, my gosh, she was in the choir, you know, Box Society Orchestra.
Whatever that is.
Yep. And not only was she in the German club there, she co-founded it. So, I mean, think of all the things she does. So she's very active within the community. And like you said, she does this wonderful thing with Best Buddies. So she's there and around 8:30, she stays afterwards and she, you know, stays late to clean up. And then she drives one of the volunteers home, and I guess she uses university station wagon.
Yeah, it said it was a borrowed university station wagon. So yeah. I don't know really what that is.
Which kind of makes sense when you live on a big campus like that. It's not a commuter campus. So, you know, she probably doesn't have a vehicle. So because of the type of service that she's providing through the university, they allow her to use one of the campus vehicles, is what I think.
Vehicles. Yeah, no, it makes sense. Now, what I would disagree with you on is that she's a senior. Most seniors have a car, but I don't know about Yale because neither you or I, just proving my point there.
That's why you didn't go there.
Neither you nor I are smart enough to get into Yale.
Speak for yourself. I turned them down.
Shit. So, however, she's using the station wagon.
Exactly.
And I think what we're trying to say is she was a very good person.
Exactly. Exactly where we're headed with that.
And we already know that she's the victim here.
Yes.
And I think what we're trying to do is paint a picture of what type of person Suzanne was, and using these different things that we know about her, is that she had the whole world in front of her. She was intelligent. She was a nice person. She was philanthropic.
She was attractive.
She was. She was an attractive girl.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, but it seems like a lot of these cases that we've been doing, the victims all have the same kind of criteria, right? They're very, very good people.
Yeah.
With the whole world in front of them. And I guess that's what makes these cases so much more tragic.
For sure.
You know, it's tragic anytime somebody loses their life.
Yes.
But the people that we've been talking about lately, and obviously that may change, and we'll have people that are not as, you can't paint as good a picture of, but the ones we've been doing, I mean, these people were either pillars of the community or young folks that were getting ready to do something special in the world.
Yeah. I mean, especially just last week's, right? Natalie.
Yeah, Natalie, for sure. I mean, I think very similar, yeah. Right? She hadn't made it to college yet, but...
But she was headed off to University of Alabama.
Getting ready to do great things.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you talked about 8:30, she left to take somebody home.
Mm-hmm.
And then at 8:45, she returned the borrowed car back to the lot, I guess, where they kept it.
Yeah, I think it was down there off of Howe Street.
And she was getting ready to walk two blocks to her apartment.
Okay.
On Park Street.
Which I thought was weird, because I read that they must have these police substations. I guess she lived near a police substation.
Yeah, actually, the way I understood it was she had a second floor apartment, and the Yale police substation was actually directly below her.
Well, if you want security, that's a good place to be.
That's a safe place to be. So a couple of things that we know. One, sometime before 8:50 PM, a few friends passed by her window and they made contact with her because they asked her if she wanted to go to the movies.
And she said she didn't, I guess she didn't want to that night.
Yeah.
She had other things going on, I'm assuming.
Yeah. I think she had schoolwork or,
gotcha.
You know, whatever it is. Cause she had already finished her thing with best buddies.
So she probably still had to study.
Yeah. Time wise, she could have gone, but I'm assuming that, right, she had, Yale-type studying to do.
Right, which is probably all the time,
I think. Which is a lot more than probably the college I went to.
Yeah, probably.
I think that's a safe assumption to make.
Yeah.
So she declines and says, she doesn't want to go to the movies. Now, the timeline moves not very far, but just after 9:00, we know that she logs into her Yale email account. Through those emails, what's discovered is that she gave a female friend the access code to her door through email. And the email was in German. So I don't know if this is a friend that is German, or this is part of that, what you called the...
German club.
The German club.
Yeah.
But either way, she apparently sent the email in German. So part of the email is stating that she's going to leave some German books for this person that she's writing the email to in her apartment lobby, right? So she's given her friend the access code,
mm-hmm,
to get into the lobby to get these books.
But first, she had to get them from... She left them with somebody else already. So she tells her friend in the email that she's going to leave these books, but first she had to go retrieve them. Then she would be able to leave them in the lobby for her friend.
And I think this is important because she does not name the person.
No.
Well, I should say, I don't know how important it is, but I think it's germane to the story because, you know, as we know, this is a mystery. So I think everything's important.
Yeah.
To some degree or another.
Because it's unknown, so you have to throw it in the mix.
Right. So we don't know who this friend was, and we don't know where she went to get the books.
Call it rabbit hole number one.
Rabbit hole number one. Yeah, because it does go on to say that this person, I mean, to this day, they've never identified who this unnamed person is.
If you knew it was you, would you even raise your hand at this point? I'd be like, no.
No, because you're going to get dragged in.
Right.
Whether you did something or not. And they're not even sure if Suzanne ever actually met with this person because she never got the book, right? So the person in the email came at some point, used the access code, the books weren't there. Now, the next thing that we know is that she logged off at 9:10. So they got some pretty good records.
Yeah, especially for that time.
Again, 1998, we think back. I think of that as being a long time ago. It's really not, but I don't know what the technology was like. But obviously, they were able to get these really detailed records. One thing we know is that at 9:10, she logged off. So they have those records. Now, what they don't know is whether or not she made any calls or received any calls, because I guess at that point, calls that happened within the
Yale system,
the Yale telephone system, were not traceable.
Right.
So I guess unlike your cell phone or your home phone, they couldn't get records.
Yeah, I guess they weren't able to do that.
Is the way I understand it.
So we know after 9:10, she logs off, and then she leaves her apartment. She heads out.
She's walking.
Yeah, that. She's walking because we know she doesn't have the car. She parked the car, and she's got to return the keys to the car to the security office.
Right. So we know what she was wearing, and that was low-cut hiking boots, a maroon fleece pullover, and jeans. Not sure how important that is, but they knew what she was wearing because it was the same exact thing that she had worn earlier in the day.
Oh, at the party.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And obviously they're going to find her body. So they know what she was wearing.
Exactly.
Gibbs, you mentioned that she's heading out on foot. Where's she going?
She's going to go head off to the security building to drop off the keys to the car.
The Yale car that she'd bought.
Yeah, that she just parked right before she went back to her apartment. So now she's got to return the keys to, I actually think they call it the communications building for the police department. So that's where she's taking the keys to.
Okay.
And that was shortly before 9:20, because we know around 9:22, she encounters a classmate that's out taking an evening stroll, I guess.
That's Peter Stein, right?
Peter Stein, exactly.
Okay. You know, they're pinpointing 9:22 based off of him.
Yeah, I'm guessing maybe the distance that he saw her versus compared to the communication center for the police. You know, if someone was walking that distance to where he ran into her, could only have been so many minutes.
Well, I figured they just talked to him and he said it was about 9:22.
Yeah, well.
Or they could use
if you ran into somebody, would you say, oh, that was 9:22.
You're right. Or they could use your Da Vinci Code method of figuring out.
That's why I turned Yale down.
Either way, they've got good records.
Yeah.
And however they got them, whether he said it was around 9:22 or they were estimating.
Yeah.
I made fun of your method, but
sure.
It could have been done.
Right.
You know, it takes X amount of minutes to walk. So, you know, she probably ran into him here at 9:22.
X time.
Now, Stein is interviewed for the Yale Daily News. And the account that he gives is of the conversation that he had with Suzanne is basically that she didn't say she was really going anywhere in particular and didn't tell him anything specific that she was going to be doing afterwards.
Okay.
So that's of no help at all.
No.
Now what he did say that she said to him is that she was very, very tired and she was looking forward to getting some sleep. Now, does that mean anything?
No.
Maybe not.
From the day she had, from it was described, who wouldn't be tired?
Right. And you know she's probably got tons of homework and...
Yeah, studying and all that.
So. Stress, and so yeah. She's probably just tired. You know, when we talk about rabbit holes, right, we're keeping everything in mind. The other thing that he said was that she was not wearing a backpack, but that she was holding and what he called one or more sheets of regular size, you know, letter size.
Like copy paper.
Copy paper.
Yeah.
8.5 by 11?
11. But he didn't know what was on it.
She didn't seem like she was scared.
Yeah.
Nervous.
Pretty calm from everything that he describes.
She wasn't running.
No.
Which, you know, I think all of that stuff's kind of important. She's sure. Just walking at a regular pace. And that they only talked for a few minutes. So like you said, Gibb, she's walking to return these keys to the borrowed car. Now, this one, I think they did base on the timeline. They based it on if she runs into Peter at this time and they talk for 2 or 3 minutes, then she's going to get to this place where she's dropping off the keys at
X time. Yeah.
Right. So we're getting up to about 9:30-ish.
Yep.
And that's really the last time that she was reported as being seen alive. So that's a very important time.
Sure. So 9:30 College Street is the last time anybody saw her alive.
Yep.
Okay.
And it's not by Peter, though. This is by another student that is walking home from a Yale hockey game. He's the last one to see her alive. They didn't speak. Obviously, he must have been interviewed afterwards and said, right. Yeah, I saw her.
Yeah, I remember seeing her after the game.
About 9:30-ish,
yeah.
Something like that. Now, we jump all the way to 9:55. And so, this is when a passerby calls 911 and says that there's a woman bleeding at the corner of Edge Hill and East Rock Road. And this is about a couple of miles from where she was last seen.
So 2 miles.
In 25 minutes, give okay. or take. Well, we don't know because 9:55 is when the call was made.
Right.
9:30 is when she was last seen. But at 9:55, she's bleeding. We just don't know when she got there. And we don't know how she got there at this point.
Yeah, we don't. Those variables are out there.
Yeah. All we know is what time somebody discovered her. And the police get there very quickly, you know, within 2 or 3 minutes. And what they find is Suzanne Jovan has been fatally stabbed 17 times in the back of her head and neck, and her throat has been slit.
That's one angry individual.
Yeah, and I think to me, and that's all we can do on these unsolved is kind of say, you know, kind of what our thoughts and theories are. 17 times is that's a lot.
Yeah. Typically that lends to somebody that probably knows you.
Yeah, I would think a profiler, and I'm not a profiler, but I would think an FBI profiler or somebody of that ilk right. would say that many stab wounds and that type of viciousness would lend itself. They would say that the perpetrator most likely is somebody that knew her and that had some emotional connection with her.
Sure.
I guess is the way I would put it.
Yeah.
And whether that emotion is hate, love, hate, jealousy,
something there.
I mean, you can put all kinds of different ones in there.
Yeah.
Now, a profile isn't always right, but I think they're right more times than not.
On this one, I just feel back of the head. So they didn't want to make eye contact. 17 times, you know, that just once wasn't enough. 17 times. Well, and then for kicks, let's go ahead and make sure that she's dead. So let's slash the throat.
Yes. So does that mean that she was somebody came up from behind, right? So she never saw her attacker.
Right.
Got up close enough and started the blows, or the, I guess the stabs, right to the back of her head and neck area, and then came across the body around front, still standing behind probably, and
slit the throat
that way. I mean, that's the way I'm picturing it in my head.
Yeah, I am too. I mean, I guess she could have fell to the ground, and because she was still alive, that the person that did this at that point kneeled down and slit the throat. But we just don't know. We don't have those details.
We don't. But what we do know, and she was found lying on her stomach.
Okay.
So maybe, not to say that you couldn't still do that.
Right.
But that makes me think that the slitting of the throat was done.
It happened while she was standing.
Prior to her
falling. Yeah.
And that not to say that you couldn't get underneath, but it would be harder.
Or you could have rolled her over on her stomach after the
Right.
But I think it makes more sense that she was probably standing when it happened.
Yeah. So like I said, she's found lying on her stomach. Her feet are out in the road. And her body's kind of in this grassy area between the road and the sidewalk to kind of paint a picture, right? So usually that little strip that you have to mow in between your sidewalk and where the street starts.
So she's laying there.
Fully clothed. Now, this is where I think it starts to get interesting. It's not a good word to use. I don't know why I use that word, because we're talking about somebody that's been killed. But this is where you I think you have to take in this information. Let me put it that way.
Right.
So like I said, fully clothed, but she still has her watch on and her earrings. We don't know what type of value.
Mm-mm.
I don't know if this is a fancy watch or gold earrings or diamond earrings, but she's still got all her jewelry on and she's got some money in her pocket. So to me, that probably rules out
robbery,
because why would you come up and kill somebody if your intent is to rob them and not take the only three things that they have on them that would probably have any value?
She had her clothes on, so it wasn't rape.
I don't think it was
sexually
motivated in any way. Playing armchair detective here, and we're also giving information to the audience. But I think those are pretty safe bets or safe assumptions to make.
Nothing was taken off of her.
And she's fully clothed. As far as I know, there was nothing sexual or no sexual acts involved. One thing I read, Gibbs, was that, you know, she, like I said, she had a couple of dollars or she had some small amount of money in her pocket, but she didn't have her wallet with her. But they later found it back in her room.
Okay. So again, it leads to the fact that, again, nobody took anything off of her.
And we'll get into more theories as we go, but we're laying the groundwork for that now. So Suzanne Jovan was officially pronounced dead at Yale New Haven Hospital at 10:26. So let's just quickly rewind that timeline. Logs off at 9:10. She heads out. She meets that one guy at 9:22.
Yeah.
Another guy sees her at 9:30.
9:30-ish.
She's found at 9:55. So this is not a lot of time.
No.
This is all happening within a very...
Basically, the last time she was seen, an hour later, she's dead.
Yes. And she's attacked within 25 minutes.
Yes.
So that's even tighter.
Yeah, close that window down more, right? And we know that the attack happened in that short period of time.
And I think that's more important. The time between 9:30 and 9:55 is actually more important than when she was pronounced dead. But even that happened in short order.
Sure. Yep, exactly.
Didn't take very long. All right, so that is the crime. Well, let's talk about the evidence, because I think that's the natural progression.
Sure.
We know this happened in 1998. So we are, I got to do my Yale math in my head. We're 19 years on, give or take.
Okay.
Happened in December. So let's say 18.
18 years.
18 plus.
Okay.
We know the case is unsolved. There's been, you know, this wasn't a huge case in when you think of the pantheon of unsolved cases.
No.
But it was huge in that area of the country.
Yeah. I mean,
the New England area and
on a prestigious campus.
Yes. Yeah. So the news coverage was massive up there. I don't know that it made the national news like Natalie Holloway or, you know, it wasn't on that level.
But it was like you said, it was pretty newsworthy up in the New England states.
Yes. In the last 18 years, there's been a lot of things that have come out in the news. A lot of things have been reported by police. A lot of things reported very quickly or very early on,
mm-hmm.
I think. So I think we need to kind of run through some of that.
Sure.
And so let's talk about the physical evidence. You know, I think the first thing you talk about is that they took some DNA from underneath her fingernails.
Okay.
And on her left hand. I don't know if that, you know, what is the importance of the left versus the right?
Well, maybe that's the only DNA they found was underneath the left hand.
No, I know it is. Yeah. I'm saying, is there significance between finding it under the left versus the right?
Yeah, and we don't know if she's left-handed, right-handed, so we don't know how she tried to protect herself.
Right, fending off.
Yeah.
You know, I just throwing everything out there. Now, they found a Fresca bottle in the bushes near where the body was found.
Yeah.
And they lifted some prints off of that. And what they got was her fingerprints. So, obviously, she had, maybe it was hers.
Yeah.
Or she touched it. She had it. But they also found an unknown person's partial palm print.
Hmm.
So right now, I mean, we're talking about two things that you would think would be are very important. You've got an unidentified palm print and you have some DNA. Obviously, we know that didn't lead to finding the killer.
Right.
Because the case is unsolved.
And the palm print could have been the guy stocking the shelf at the store.
It definitely could have been.
It could have been.
And the DNA could have been.
It could have been when she was something earlier else. In the day. And she scratched somebody by accident or.
You never know.
You just don't know.
And we may talk about it. But what I assume is that they've run that DNA.
I would hope. Especially in today's age.
Yes. You know, they did whatever they did in 1998. Whatever the technology allowed, but they've run it since.
If I was a criminal today, I'd be very worried if I did something back in the day.
Oh, you ain't kidding.
And you left enough DNA behind because the technology today, they're going to run it eventually and they will find you.
And they have done a lot of that. If you think about.
Well, the rape case, a lot of rape kits have been solved.
Yeah.
You know, because the rape kit, they, you know, it's costly to do this, but. They eventually get enough money, they send some off, they get it, and they end up finding who the rapist was. So hopefully they'll find some of these murderers out there as well.
All right, so we've talked about two pieces of physical evidence. The third is the tip of the knife.
Yeah.
That was used in the attack was actually lodged in her skull.
So how forceful would you have to be to make sure that that knife, when it went into the skull, the tip broke off.
Yeah.
I mean, you're pretty pissed at somebody. Pretty vicious. Use that force, I would think.
I don't know about you, but I'm picturing this attack as unbelievably vicious.
Yeah.
I'm just picturing it in my mind as, you know, this knife coming down.
Exactly.
17 times. You don't need 17.
No.
Right. Probably the throat slit alone would have probably killed her. I don't know how bad it was, but most of the time, if you cut somebody across the jugular, that's enough.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I hear it's enough.
I hear it. Yeah. I'm not talking by experience and I'm not a doctor. So we got, they got the tip of the knife. So presumably they could match that up if they ever found the rest of the knife.
Sure.
So I think that's the three top pieces of physical evidence. And then you get into not physical evidence, but things that were seen or things that were talked about. And one, the first one on that list is like a tan or brown van that was stopped in the roadway immediately adjacent to where the body was found.
Okay.
And then you have a man, 20s, 30s, it says, with an athletic build, well-groomed, dark pants, loose-fitting green jacket. And by all accounts, he was booking it.
Yeah.
Like a track star, running in the opposite direction of where Suzanne was killed.
Sounds guilty to me.
Yes.
That's rabbit hole number two.
That doesn't sound good.
No.
So number three goes back to what we talked about in her email. And that's this person that she lent the books to.
Right.
That she was needing to pick up so that she could give to her friend.
Right.
And that person's unidentified. So Gibbs, apparently this was on 2020. They did a special.
Okay.
Back in 2000. And there was some speculation about the murder weapon in that show. And the statement made was that the medical examiner identified, I guess, that only one of the 17 stab wounds was fatal. They also had some information about what they thought the murder weapon, the knife, would be like. And so they thought it was a 4 to 5 inch non-serrated carbon steel knife. And part of that, I assume they were able to deduce from having the tip.
Well, I would think they had the tip and they could figure out from that
what the rest of the knife
length would have been.
Yeah. What the knife would have been like.
Yeah. Of course they would have known it was carbon steel because of the piece they had. Yes. They could have easily determined that.
Yeah. And I'm sure they could have deduced some of the other things from the actual stab wounds themselves. Right. So a serrated blade would make a much different wound type, I would think, than an unserrated.
So 4 to 5 inches. So that's basically the length of a smartphone, maybe?
One of the
smaller smartphones. Not the plus ones, but the
normal. Like a smaller iPhone, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah. That's about 4 or 5 inches, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's a pretty decent size blade.
Yeah, I mean, what they don't say, that'd be a pretty good size folding knife.
Yeah.
So to me, that would probably be more of a fixed, what would they call that? A fixed blade.
Yeah.
Like with a handle. We talked about this van, and this is where you get into the issue of whether did she walk from where the guy from the hockey game saw her to where she was ultimately found.
The 2 miles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did she walk that 2 miles or was she picked up by somebody and driven there, or was she killed? I don't know. I think that's where you get into that conversation though.
Yeah. I think that's hard to determine for me because I know I can walk 2 miles on that distance. You know, I can walk that distance in that amount of time.
Well, I know, but there was a lot of stuff on the internet that was talking about how the general assumption is that she either voluntarily or involuntarily got in a car.
Yeah.
Because she couldn't have gotten there by foot in that short amount of time.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking 25 minutes...
It's doable. Well,
but that's not leaving any time for her to be killed.
Well, I guess that's what you got to back out. I mean, how long could that have taken to be stabbed
17 times. It would so take a little while.
Say it was the confrontation was 5 minutes.
Right.
So
maybe that's why people are making the assumption that she couldn't have walked that far.
Yeah.
Because the confrontation would have been longer. So yeah, anyway, there is a lot of chatter and a lot of writing on the internet.
Yeah.
That people do not believe that she could have gotten there. I don't know if I believe that. But again, like we said, a lot of it depends on the timing. And we don't know between 9:30 and 9:55 how much of that time was the altercation itself. And we don't know how long she was laying there in the street.
Well, that's true, too, before she was noticed.
Before 9:55. Right. So that does lend some credence, maybe, to the fact that all of this happened.
And I'm guessing that some of the people that live there probably try, or at least the police probably did, is walk that distance.
Yeah.
To see if they could get to that spot and then back out, you know, how long the crime took place. And
they're just thinking it's too close.
Yeah, or, too close.
Yeah.
So then they start thinking that she must have hitchhiked or picked up a ride from a friend or something. Is that what they're alluding to?
Well, I think they think it's either that or she was made to get in a car.
Okay.
Or this brown van. And I think that's why this brown van.
So the brown van's coming back into the picture.
Yeah. Is comes into play. The police didn't make that public, this brown van, until about 3 years after the murder.
That seems strange. I know sometimes they like to keep things to themselves while they investigate, to not throw any suspicion on the people, right?
Yeah, but you wouldn't think that would be one, because right. You would think getting that out there to the public would be, you know, would help maybe generate a lead.
I would think so.
Because you're not giving away, you know, how she was killed or these specifics that where you get the crackpots that come forward. Because somebody says, I have a brown van, they wouldn't know all the other specifics. But there must have been a reason why they thought it was important to hold back that information. Now, what they did do is they started to ask people privately and, you know, investigate individuals regarding the van.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody knows why they waited so long to release it publicly.
And did they find one?
No. As far as I know, there's never been a link with the van.
Okay. So there's nothing tying the van to this at all.
Right.
Okay.
And again, with the Fresca bottle, that didn't come out for a couple of years either. I think it was, you know, sometime in 2001. What I wrote down, Gibbs, was that there was only one store in the vicinity of the whole Yale campus that sold Fresca.
Okay.
And also would have been open during that time frame. Now, that doesn't mean she couldn't have brought the Fresca from her house.
Right. But then again, I don't think she did, because
that's right.
The one guy saw her, he said she only had one or two pieces of copy paper in her hand.
And nothing in her other hand.
Right. So she must on her way. So she stopped off between that time frame to get something to drink. So then that does shorten that, the chances of her getting from point A to point B in 25 minutes. Because now she stopped off to get a soda. Well, that could probably took 5 minutes in the store.
Well, yes. And what's the chances that that store is on along that route?
Right.
The store would have to be along the exact route that she was walking.
And maybe that's where she met somebody to get into a vehicle. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, what it did say was that the store is a block from her apartment.
Okay.
What it didn't say was that it was on the same route that to the murder scene.
Yeah. So,
but I don't think it was, and that maybe lends more credence to the fact that she couldn't have walked those 2 miles, went to the store and also made it there in time to be stabbed for however many minutes it took.
So now it's kind of making sense to me a little bit.
It does.
That maybe she left where she was at in the park and, you know, the guy from the hockey game sees her. Maybe she's headed back home, stops off at the store, gets herself a Fresca, and then somehow she gets, instead of making it back to her apartment, in my mind, I'm picturing that she gets picked up by somebody and she's killed and dropped off, you know, further away to throw the to me. That's what I'm picturing right now.
Yeah,
in my
mind. I get you. And as we're talking about this, if she did buy this Fresca, and it sounds like she must have because she didn't have it with her.
Yeah.
And there's only one store where she could have gotten it. You know, apparently they had some video recording.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, if they're a typical 24-hour store, don't they have tapes to show?
I don't know if it was a 24-hour store, but...
Yeah. Well, it was a convenience store. And yeah. I know around here, convenience stores, because they unfortunately get robbed a lot, that they have, you know, security cameras playing.
Yeah. And by all accounts, they did.
Okay.
But here's where I think people get very upset is that the police never asked to view the tape.
No.
And
why?
They never talked to any store employees or customers that were there.
Wow.
And that upsets people.
Sure. It's disturbing, especially if I was one of her family members.
Because, you know, I know from having worked in retail long, long time ago.
Yeah.
And I actually, you know, did manage some gas stations back in the day.
Yeah.
My younger years. You know, we had those tapes, but eventually you start to write over those tapes.
So you recycle them.
Yeah. I think back in the day we had a tape for every day.
Okay.
And so you had only 6 days or.
So the tape on Monday, when it came back to Monday again, you popped it back in and reused it.
If I'm remembering correctly, that's how.
Okay.
And that was in the middle 90s.
Yeah.
So it would have been similar time frame.
Yeah.
You know, I doubt they had digital.
Like today, they're probably they're on a hard drive.
Yeah.
You know, so you can go back and find stuff.
And they can save it for much longer. I would imagine a small store like that would have had more of a VHS type setup. Yeah.
And they might just replay the same tape daily.
They could have.
Yeah.
They could have. But it doesn't matter because the police never asked for it. You know, they could have got it that night. They could have got it the next day, maybe.
Yeah.
But you know now that's gone forever. So I like I said, that I think that upset a lot of people. The other thing is we talked about the palm print on that Fresca bottle.
Yeah.
And they have never identified the palm print, but they also, one thing that they have not done is tried to get DNA from the bottle itself. So they have the DNA under her fingernails, but they never tried to
see if somebody else's DNA was on the, where you drank from.
Right. Or I don't know if you can get DNA from.
Oh, from a swab of the palm.
From where the palm was.
Yeah.
I don't know how that works.
But they didn't try.
Yeah. They didn't try at all. And again, that's where people start to get very suspicious of law enforcement.
Yeah.
And start to think, you know, that's where you hear the words cover up and you hear people aren't doing their jobs. Now, I'm not saying that because I don't know, but it does seem strange to me that they didn't follow up.
It makes you wonder why. And I guess because we don't have someone from the New Haven Police Department to ask, but I would want to know. So why did no one think to go to the convenience store and to preview the tape? Right. And why didn't we get DNA testing done?
Right.
I mean, to me, it just seems like something you would do.
Right. And I don't know why all this stuff happened in 2001, but that's when they started doing something with the fingernail DNA as well.
So, and you said this was three years later?
Well, it happened in 98.
So.
But it happened in December. So yeah. two years and something.
Right.
Almost 3 years because it was October of 2001
yeah.
before they really started to do much with the fingernail. And what they did is they started to ask colleagues and friends of Suzanne Jovan's to come forward and give DNA samples.
Yeah.
So that they could try to match it. You know, all of this kind of throws a lot of suspicion, or maybe not, maybe suspicion's not the right word, but it definitely throws up some red flags about how the case was handled, maybe.
Sure. And I think we see this a lot on the Unsolved Ones. And I don't know if it's just the frustration by the victim's loved ones when something doesn't get solved. I think the frustration comes about and you don't think that the police or the investigation unit's doing all they should be doing.
Right.
Because you're not getting any answers. And you're not getting them because either they can't share those with you right now because they're working them, or they just don't have anything to share and you want to know why they aren't doing more.
So, you know, in the very beginning, we were talking about the fingernail DNA.
Yeah.
And we made an assumption that it was probably being tested throughout the years.
Right.
But that was wrong.
So it wasn't.
It wasn't.
Why wasn't it?
Well, I forgot because I'm in my notes now. And as late as 2009, her parents really got involved writing to the governor and was really talking about how they, you know, had not tested this DNA. The lab, you know, the state lab had to admit that they had a backlog of 12,000 samples.
Wow.
That needed to be tested. They had not been testing it.
So it's just backlogged sitting there on the shelf.
Right. Maybe waiting in some order or something, but.
And I don't get that. I just don't understand. Now I know that, I mean, clearly this costs the county and the state, you know, X amount of dollars to run these DNA testing, but is it that much or is it, you just think it's a shortage of manpower to run it?
Oh, I think it's a combination of time and money.
Money. Yeah.
I mean, maybe they have a budget.
Right.
Right. So maybe they can only test so many, but within a given cycle. So there was an important thing that came out in 2008, Gibbs. And, you know, by this time they had put together this Jovan task force, they called it.
Okay.
And what they revealed was that a few days after the crime, a female motorist told police that she was driving in the area at about 10 p.m. when she saw a white male sprint past her and disappear into the church property. Now, is that same person that we said was booking it?
Maybe.
I don't know. The question was, why had this not come up for nearly a decade? And it's this point when the main suspect comes into play. And what is said is that the police at the time showed this female motorist a photo of Yale professor James Vanderveld. And Vanderveld had been Suzanne Jovan's thesis advisor.
Okay.
Right? Remember, she's in her senior year.
Yeah. And she just dropped it off earlier that day to him, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And at this point, police had already publicly identified him as a suspect.
Okay.
And so they're showing his picture around and they show it to this lady who's now come forward. I have no idea why she waited so long to come forward. But they showed it to her and said, "Is this the man you saw?" The other thing that they did, because what you have to realize is that they've focused in on him. He is their
Number one. Okay.
At this point in time. The other thing they did, which I thought was a little odd, they drove this female motorist that came forward in an unmarked van to his office so that they could wait for him to come out so that she could see him in person walking.
Okay.
Outside of the van. So I guess akin to doing a police lineup.
Yeah.
She's behind. Like, he can't see her, but she can see him.
Okay. So she's looking and catches him walking. And so does she recognize him?
She tells the investigators that's not the man.
Oh.
That she saw running.
So she remembers from 10 years ago what the man looked like. I would think that'd be hard to remember.
I think it would be too, but by all accounts, she said that's not the guy.
Yeah. Okay.
And what is said is that she was never contacted again. Because again, I think at this point, this Joven Task Force, as it's called,
mm-hmm.
is focused in on nobody but this Vandeveld guy. I mean, they go to the extreme of hanging a sketch of what they say was the person that she described around the neighborhood. I've seen the sketch and I put it on the Facebook.
Yeah.
I think what they might as well have just taken this guy's picture.
Picture. And
it looks very similar.
Yeah. So it's like
I'm not saying they did that. I'm not accusing anybody of doing that.
Yeah. So the sketch looks like him, but when she sees him in person, she says it's not him. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. She did not identify him as the man she saw.
But yet the sketch that she gave them, they're putting out there anyway.
Yeah. And it just happens to look exactly like this guy.
Yeah. Okay.
So whether that is the real details that she gave the sketch art, I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know if you've ever seen Making a Murderer.
No.
The documentary.
No.
You know, it kind of blew up and became this big thing. And one of the parts of Making a Murderer was that the sketch artist, I think, if I remember correctly, the suspicion was that he used a photo to come up with his drawing.
Okay.
And the photo was the person that they thought had done it.
Oh.
Now, and Making a Murderer was huge, so if I got that wrong, people are going to blast me. But it was something like that.
Gotcha.
And again, I'm not accusing them of doing that.
No.
It just happens to look a lot like
the yeah. professor.
And people can go online and check that out. So, you know, Gibby, one thing we talked about was that email. And that email comes back around in 2008. You know, so Suzanne's final email that she sent to her friend in German,
mm-hmm.
the task force gave out some more details. Again, now we're 10 years on.
Right. Yeah.
And they're, you know, giving out details. And this was the email that said, you know, here's my access code. I'll have the books for you in the lobby. So what we know is that she had lent out these books. And what the task force is saying is that, you know, these books were never returned
yep.
to anywhere. Nobody's ever come forward to identify themselves as the borrower. And that's led to the speculation that the borrower may have had something to do with the killing, with the murder.
Yeah. I don't really buy it though. Why would you kill somebody over a textbook or two?
Well, I don't think you would kill them over a textbook.
Yeah.
But the fact that they didn't come, nobody's come forward.
Right.
Also, they thought the way that she uses the word someone.
Yeah.
They thought that was very strange.
That she didn't use a specific name.
Yeah. Instead of, you know, I got to go to Brian's and get those books. You know, does that mean that it's someone that she doesn't want to disclose?
It might be
somebody that she's having a relationship with. I don't know.
Yeah. Or someone she doesn't really know that well.
Yeah. Either way. But I mean, to your point, right. I don't think anybody's going to kill somebody over textbook.
Right.
But the fact that they haven't come forward after all this scrutiny and said, well, yeah, I have the textbooks. She was supposed to come get them and she never did.
Yeah. She never showed up. Right.
Has, you know,
but because we don't know, it's another, wonder what that's about.
We've talked a lot about the investigation already, and we talked about James Vandeveld as the prime suspect. What we didn't say, and we said, you know, his name came out, it was leaked to the media. So as we've talked about in other cases, right, whether he did it or not, his life is forever changed by being named the prime suspect. This happened 4 days after the murder. Now, it took them 15 months to come out and say that they had no physical evidence tying Vandeveld to the case. Nothing to link him to the crime. Now, one important part, and this is where Henry Lee comes in, and I don't know if you know who Henry Lee is. He's one of the most famous criminologists. He was going to come into the OJ case at one point, but he's been in a lot of
high profile cases.
He offers his help to reconstruct the crime scene and to lend his experience, but the police don't take him up on that offer.
Now, why wouldn't they do that?
Again, leading people to
think, are you hiding something?
Right. To think that they're either hiding something or they're not doing their job or. Right. So there was a lot of questions. If you go online, there's a lot of questioning of the way that this was handled, you know, from zeroing in on James Vandeveld to naming him so early, you know, in the investigation. You know, did they get tunnel vision, which you hear a lot, where you get somebody in your crosshairs and you exclude everybody else, so you're not you're not following those leads that you should be. So in 2000, Gibbs, and this was, you know, led by Vandeveld himself and his colleagues at Yale, because I think they were behind him. They never thought he did this. They were encouraging Yale to hire its own private investigator to study this case.
So a few years after the murder.
Yeah, a couple years.
You know, we find out that this occurred, right? They tell us about this finally, that this happened.
Yep. And they do hire actually a couple people. So they do test the DNA from her fingernail against Vandeveld, and it's not a match.
Part of this investigation, they talk about, did she have an affair with this professor?
Right.
And it's kind of ruled out. Her friends ruled out. Her boyfriend rules it out. And I think you can go back to, I think it was around 2000 that they did. The professor got a couple of investigators involved, and they tested his DNA against the DNA underneath her fingernails, and they determined that it wasn't his. So, again, I think between that and the friends saying that there was no affair, I think that kind of clears him that he's not a suspect.
It does. Yeah. And I've got, one audio clip that I wanted to play, and it's a friend of, Vandeveld's, you know, that came out very early on and was critical.
Really what happened was I was told by, I think it was my mother. She said that, your friend Jim, has been named in this, horrific murder. And of course you think to yourself, you know, as everybody does, well, maybe this guy could have done it, maybe he didn't do it. But, you know, people always say, it's the cliche, oh, I know so-and-so, he couldn't have done it.
Name a few aspects of the case that make you certain that James Vandeveld is not the murderer.
Well, the first thing the police has always said is that Suzanne Jovan must have known her killer. Now, why is that? Well, they say, well, because, what, knife wounds or a crime of passion or something like that. But if you look at, I mean, that maybe statistically has some truth to it, although most people who are killed by knives who have a crime of passion are killed in their house, not on a street somewhere. And if you look at her route that she took that day and everything that she said to people, such as, I'm tired, I'm going home, you say, well, she couldn't have been stalked because she's going through locked gates and across Yale's old campus. She's taking a roundabout route home. So, okay, she wasn't stalked. Then, could somebody have offered her a ride or something like that? Well, her route has her almost about a minute or two from being home. So that doesn't seem like a possibility. Was it a secret meeting? Well, if you're secretly meeting somebody, you're not almost, home. You're probably waiting somewhere for a ride or something. So none of the usual things that you would think of for how she could know somebody. And then from the time that she was last probably alive in the Yale campus area to where she was found dead, it was only about 20 minutes later.
Do you have a theory?
Well, I think it just points to some sort of a, random act of violence. I mean, somebody saw an opportunity there, maybe to rob her, maybe for some other reason. And probably more than one person, because it's hard for one person in a vehicle. We know she had to have been in a vehicle to get from where she was probably last seen around the Yale campus to a couple of miles away within 20 minutes. There's some sort of evidence that's presented where you can fight and say, wait a minute, that's not true. Well, here we have a situation where he's been named a suspect that never in 3 years has anybody had one piece of evidence at all. There's no blood, there's no fiber, there's no, you know, motive, there's no fingerprints, there's nothing at all. Not one thing that you can say, hey, that's not true. It's just the police named him 3 days after the murder. They interviewed him, and since then, that was even before they interviewed witnesses, before they analyzed the evidence they had, and it was ludicrous. It was almost like, let's make it a self-fulfilling prophecy. We're on this national stage. Everybody's watching us. We have to calm everybody down. We'll name this guy and hope to heck that we're right. And we'll do everything we can to make the public think that we've got him. And everything that they did, I mean, they put up posters that led from where the crime scene was down to his place. They would put articles in the Register or the local papers saying that we found forensic evidence, which turned out to be like a driver's manual in a bush. I mean, everything that they would put in the paper would make people believe that, hey, maybe we got this guy, but there was never anything at all.
So, I mean, I think, you know, like, this is his friend, right?
Sure.
And he's coming out basically defending his friend.
Yeah.
And, but what a lot of what he says really, you know, does make some sense. And obviously we know that Vandeveld didn't match the DNA.
Right.
So the assumption is that he's not the guy. So, you know, you hear this guy talking but I mean, they really went after this guy.
Yeah, they sure did.
I mean, they went as far as, you know, contacting the U.S. Navy, which I guess he did something with the Navy, Vandeveld did. And they were trying to get the Navy not to renew his contract.
Wow.
You know, they were really after him. I mean, they traveled to Washington, D.C. to meet with Navy officials.
That's extreme for somebody that they don't know if he's, I mean, at that point, in their eyes, he was just a suspect. Right?
Yeah.
So they're doing all this. I mean, it's just, what do they know that they haven't told that makes them feel like they could basically ruin someone's life?
Yeah. And to be honest with you, I'm not even sure the timing of this. I don't know if it was before or after the DNA didn't match him.
Yeah, that's true too. Regardless, it's interesting to me that they went to such extremes for somebody that they can never convict because they didn't have anything.
Yeah. But, you know, no matter what the evidence, it seemed like no matter what the evidence showed, they did not get off of him.
No.
And
they had some other leads, right?
Yeah.
Eventually.
I mean, it came, we'll talk about in a minute, but it comes pretty far down the road.
Okay.
But, you know, Vandeveld, he went as far as contacting the Connecticut State Cold Case Unit to try to get them to take over the case.
Mm.
So he's trying to get them to investigate it.
He wants New Haven off of it.
Yes.
Okay.
Because they're kind of centered on him, right. I think. And, you know, it was about 8 years after the murder in 2006 that the Suzanne Jovan murder was officially classified as a cold case. Mm-hmm. And it was moved to the Connecticut Cold Case Unit.
Okay.
But there were some strange things about that because, you know, it was never added to their website, to the Cold Case Unit website. They never mentioned the reward that was being offered. So even once it moved there, you know, people had reservations about how it was being handled. And so Vandeveld he started writing letters again, complaining. You know, which to me does not sound like something that a guilty person would do.
Right.
You know, you just slink away, try to slink away into the shadows.
Right. Not put more spotlight on you.
Right. So in November of 2007, the assistant state's attorney admitted that the case had been secretly reassigned back to New Haven.
Okay. Now that's so again, what's all the secrecy about? and why the... I don't get it. I don't know what's going on there.
I mean, how could the Connecticut cold case unit not be better than... Now, what they did say is that this time they handpicked a team of four retired detectives. But how could that group be better than the state's cold case unit?
Right.
The assistant state's attorney comes out and says, you know, he's quoted as saying, no person is a suspect in the crime, and everyone is a suspect in the crime.
Okay. Huh.
But then later on, it said that it was moved back to the state cold case unit.
Okay.
I don't know. It's all over the map.
Yeah, dude. It sounds like it was really handled poorly.
Yeah. So Gibbs, there is one more suspect to talk about. And this doesn't come really to light until 2012. And what happens is that there are some tips that come in from some local residents, really indicating that, and I don't know where they got this from, but that a mentally disturbed Yale graduate student might have been the killer.
Hmm.
And then it got a little bizarre because before the police could even, so we don't know if this was the guy or not, because before police can even get into it and start investigating him, he dies. And he doesn't just die. He commits suicide by running out on the interstate.
Okay.
So now again, if he really is mentally disturbed, was that a part of it? Or was it the fact that maybe he knew that they were starting to look at him? There might be something there.
That's another rabbit hole, man. That's bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, all the officials ever came out and said is that they could not make a connection.
Well, 12, 14 years later, how could you make a connection?
Yeah,
I think it'd be hard.
I think it would be tough. So, I mean, there was a little bit, you know, to this story, though, because there was an individual who, and they never released this guy's real name.
Right.
So on the internet, you see him called Billy.
Billy.
Because he was never officially charged or anything. So his name's not on the register, I guess. But so anyway, we'll call him Billy because that's how you see it. But apparently there was a gentleman that had been trying to help Billy. And one night Billy shows up at his door and he's all agitated and Billy's yelling about how angry he is with his parents. And so this guy says, you know, let's go for a walk. We'll try to calm you down. And Billy turns to him and says, there's something I have to tell you. I'm obsessed with the murder of Suzanne Jovan.
Wow.
Which is a little strange.
That's strange.
Right. Obviously this is before he kills himself or he wouldn't be able to.
Yeah.
Have this walk and talk. I mean, to take it a little further. So if you believe this guy that tells the story about taking the walk with Billy, there's another story about him, Billy, and this guy's roommate sitting in their apartment. And something came on the TV about the case. And Billy turns to the roommate and says, they'll never catch me. Hmm. Now, obviously, if that's true, that's pretty damning stuff.
Right.
But I don't know how true it is.
Right. Or was he just saying something stupid to say something? You know what I'm saying? You know, I mean, he's just sitting there trying to act like he's something that he did something they didn't.
Yeah. I mean, you know, depending on this guy's mental state, you just don't know. But. You know, it's interesting. All right, Gibbs, I think we want to bring this one to a close and talk about some litigation. You know, as we talked about, the police centered in on Vandeveld.
Yeah, the professor.
They hounded him. They probably made, you know, kind of made his life a living hell.
I think so.
So, you know, he sued a number of people. In 2001, he sued the university for wrongfully dismissing him from a graduate program that wasn't Yale. It was another university that he was enrolled in. And I guess from what I read, they dropped a lawsuit for a settlement.
Okay.
So also in 2001, he sued the New Haven Police Department, basically stating that they violated his civil rights in the way that they named him publicly.
Okay.
As a suspect, while claiming other suspects existed, I guess.
Yeah.
But they never named anybody else but him.
But him. And they went per, we know, like you said, they went after his contract with the Navy.
Yes.
it's pretty extensive.
And then he added Yale.
Oh, really?
In the lawsuit a couple of years later. So okay. This lawsuit was dragging on. So he added Yale. And at the end result was both New Haven and Yale, they agreed to a monetary settlement with him.
So they all ponied up and paid.
And it wasn't. And that settlement wasn't until 2013, so like took like 12 years in litigation. And it was about, at that time that the state's attorney finally admitted publicly for the first time that Vandeville was no longer a suspect.
Wow. Talking about a long time.
Right.
Yeah. Was that 15, 16 years?
Yes. 15 years at least.
Yeah.
Or around 15 years.
Wow.
So I'm assuming this guy didn't do it. And if he didn't, I really feel bad for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because he kind of got raked through the coals.
Sure.
And at the same time, it sounds to me like they spent so much time zeroed in on him that they didn't do some of the things that they should have and
right.
Branching out and
dive in deeper to some other suspects. Yeah. Maybe.
I mean, I'm not throwing him under the bus because I don't know
everything,
but that's what it sounds like from the material that's out there. So that's the story of Suzanne Jovan. Hopefully this is one that I think that they could solve.
Potentially.
They have some DNA.
Yeah.
This could be one that in years to come, that DNA could show up as a match and they can put this one to rest. All right, well, that's it. So for Mike Ferguson,
Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.